nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, well, today in Lecture 5, I'm going to talk about targeting nanomedical systems to cells. We won't get too far into the assessing specificity, although I'll talk a little bit about that. And then next time, we will get into that in much more detail. And in terms of targeting molecules when we're building these nanosystems and we want to get them to find their targets, there's sort of three general types of targeting molecules. That's not to say that there aren't variations on these and in fact, some other things. But I'm going to today spend time first walking you through antibody targeting. And I apologize, I'm going to assume that since you all have very different backgrounds, some of you may be a little bored. I'll go through some of the basics of antibodies, but hang in there because I'll probably say a few things that you might not have thought of in quite those terms. So, and that will be in enough detail that you'll see how that relates to the peptide targeting, which is really kind of almost a subset of the antibody targeting. And then aptamer targeting is quite different and has a lot of other attractive features, so I will go into those in some detail. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about, in this slide I say how monoclonal antibodies are made, but let's first introduce what a polyclonal. Polyclonal means a whole collection of antibodies, and typically in a polyclonal, one would inject some material, antigenic material. Antigenic material just means anything that elicits an immune response in the mouse. And then the mouse raises antibodies against that, maybe. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Then you collect the serum, and you basically have a collection of all the other antibodies that the mouse has made, plus the ones that are directed against the thing that you injected. And those are called polyclonal. And because of that, it used to be that those were very hard to work with, and people had to get quite clever learning how to stain with polyclonal antibodies, and you had to absorb all the backgrounds away and get quite clever with that. And as we talk today, what I will do is, since I started my career back with polyclonals and was there at the sort of the dawn of monoclonal antibody productions when those were first made, I'll indicate a few things that people get a little sloppy with monoclonal antibodies because they assume you don't really need to do these things. And in many cases, you do need to take advantage of those. So this was a bit crude. It also depended on a particular animal and animal-to-animal variations. And so people got the idea that there might be a better way. And in fact, the guys who thought this up, that there was a better way to make antibodies, won the Nobel Prize for that. And they basically came up with an idea that if you tried immunizing the mouse, and then you took cells from the spleen and you fused them with myeloma cells, there's various things that you could do. You could fuse the cells in a way that would lead to a hybrid cell, hence it's called a hybridoma, that would continue to proliferate, and you could harvest those. You could also get all the other possible combinations which would ultimately lead to cell death. So if you actually grew these up, you would select for the cell which consists of the original spleen cells and the hybridoma, and the spleen cells have a complete sort of, each of those spleen cells has one particular antibody specificity. And so you come out with a hybridoma which has one particular specificity. Now, you still have to select for that, you still have to purify it, but the idea is that you've now created an immortal cell. That myeloma cell that you fused it with was actually a cancer cell which had an immortal cancer cell which had the ability to grow without limits. So now you end up with something that can effectively, that one cell can grow and it can make many copies of itself, just as a cancer cell would, but it also makes many, many copies of one particular monoclonal antibody. And we'll learn what that really means in terms of specificity. Now, that said, when you do this initial screening, there are two ways that people would grow this up. One way would be that they would take these cells and they would inject them back into the peritoneal cavity of the mouse, and the mouse would effectively be an incubator and grow, and it would get quite large with these tumor cells that were secreting antibodies. And when you grow it that way, you'll find the monoclonal antibodies labeled as ascites. And that usually means that they're grown in very, very high concentration, and you need to know that there's a concentration difference between that as opposed if you grow them directly in tissue culture. Now, it used to be that everybody grew those in ascites, and then animal rights people had a lot of problems with that. They said, you don't really need to do that, and they were right. It is kind of a cruel and unusual punishment of a mouse to sit there and grow tumor cells in its peritoneal cavity. So in fact, you're going to see very little of this in the future. There's still a few things out there, but in general, most of that has been shut down, and most of the hybridomas are grown as so-called supernatants. So they literally just take, the antibody is secreted from these cells off into the medium, tissue culture medium, and you literally take that medium and you concentrate it. Now, that's a good thing for the animal. It's probably a good thing for the purity of the antibody. It also means that you have to do a considerable concentration, and typically it's not anywhere near as high as the ascites was. So now what you'll do is you'll actually get the antibody and it'll be calibrated in so many milligrams per ml of antibody. And that's where you start actually using it. So monoclonal antibodies have very specific recognition of a very small region, and we'll see what that means. There's some advantages and disadvantages to that.
I have a quick question.
Yeah. There's multiple ways that you can fuse the cell. Most people did it with polyethylene glycol and just put the cells together and cause the membranes to fuse. You can also do it with electroporation. Electroporation is probably even a little rougher than the PEG fusion. So most of it was done with polyethylene glycol fusion. Okay. Now, when you make those antibodies, there are some characteristics. They were first made particularly in mice. So they're called murine antibodies. And unfortunately, what those are an antibody is a protein. And when they started doing this therapeutically in people, and we're interested in putting these into people for our nanomedical devices, people started developing sometimes severe and violent allergic reactions against these mouse proteins. So very quickly, it was a very short period of time, and then they pretty much had to shut that down and start finding ways to reduce the immunogenicity of these, because it just became to the point where it was dangerous to use. So one of the things that you find out about an antibody is that this is the portion of the antibody that is recognizing the antigen. And there's two regions on here on a typical bivalent antibody. And at the end of the region where it's doing the recognition of the antigen is a so-called variable region. And that's the thing that is there's all kinds of potential combinations of amino acids that give rise to a shape recognition. And we'll talk about what that really means. But the shape recognition then is only really in this portion. And all the rest of this really doesn't, we can make a lot of changes in that without changing the recognition of the antibody. So very quickly, people came to doing what was so-called a chimeric antibody. And a chimera is basically saying, let's cut off this portion of the mouse and just replace it with an equivalent region of a human antibody, human sequences. which are amino acid sequences recognized by the body as being self and not foreign. So chimeric antibodies were relatively easy to make, and they went quite a bit of the way toward being useful. They certainly showed that that was the right direction. Now, unfortunately, there were still people having problems with this. So what ended up happening is they found out that of all this region up here in the antigen combining area, there were only really subregions of that that were important. And they had to do, there were a lot of experiments, and this is not an easy thing to do, but they would literally mutagenize and change the amino acid sequence one at a time and find out if it lost antigen recognition. So when you do that, you end up with something like this with an antibody, and the green regions are still the mouse regions. So these are mouse amino acids, but you see you've reduced it. Initially, it would have been all green, and now you've reduced it to a very small number, and so you've reduced most of the immunogenicity. And this is very hard work to humanize an antibody. Okay, it takes a lot of sophistication, a lot of hard work, and therefore these things can get very expensive to make, which is another reason why we may want to consider that might not be a great idea for using those. This is also a very big molecule. This protein, if we take the entire thing, is typically over 200,000 Daltons, depending on the structure of the antibody. So this is a big structure. And when we're talking about nanoscale devices, this is really quite large. Okay. Another thing, when people started making antibodies, and I'm just trying to get you into the literature so when you see things, it'll make sense to you. People made monoclonal antibodies in different parts of the world. They made it from different mice. And sometimes those resulting antibodies were very different. But what they quickly discovered was that people in different places were really making antibodies that had similar or related specificity. So in 1982, they actually had the world's first congress, and I believe it was in Vienna, where they assembled to compare everybody's antibodies, and they came up with something called a cluster designation. Now, initially, they were getting quite fancy with that, and they were going to do some statistical things, and some people have, which is why it was called a cluster designation. But it's really quite a bit simpler operation, where you simply say that if two things are related, if they have similar specificity toward a particular type of cell, then they would have the same cluster designation. They would still have their own unique clone number. You know, the clone made in one part of the world might have some esoteric name given to it in that laboratory. You know, Joe's clone number one, as Bill's clone number three, but they both may have had the same cluster designation. And so these cluster designations started out being on leukocytes, just on blood cells, because they were trying to do tissue typing and trying to worry. This is when there was a lot of concern and research in terms of AIDS. So a lot of it was directed toward B cells and particularly T cells for AIDS. So when they started doing that, obviously a cell has a repertoire of molecules on its surface. And so very quickly, they started developing what was eventually called an immunophenotype. And that is that you could define a cell in terms of its collection of characteristics of different receptors that would bind these monoclonal antibodies. So it had molecules on the surface. These monoclonal antibodies would come down and bind that. And then the overall characteristic would be known as the immunophenotype. In this particular case, for example, a CD3 was a cluster designation that was called a pan-T, meaning it stained all human T cells, or virtually all. You always end up with some, as you get deeper into it, some exceptions. But virtually all human T cells, and from a very early point as they start to develop from the more primordial stem progenitor cells. When they start developing into helper and suppressor subsets, then you end up with CD4 and CD8 corresponding to those different cell types. So you could have a cell which is a CD3 positive, CD4 positive, CD8 negative, and that would be one particular cell type. Now, this has become quite popular. If you go to every hospital in the country and all around the world, when you have blood samples taken, and also for tumor typing, for cancers, for lymphomas and leukemias, they will do this. They will have a designation for every lymphoma and leukemia in terms of a typing of those. Now, that was such a good idea that it quickly went from being leukocytes to epithelial cells, all manner of different cell types. And there are literally more than a couple of hundred different cluster designations right now that specify different types of cells. And you have dendritic cells, you have all of the blood cell types, even you start looking at cell types which you wouldn't even think of. Cardiac cell types can have certain antigens expressed on them in certain ways. So it became a very general thing used to identify things. So we're going to talk about that. We'll be doing a lot of this in the next lecture, where we'll actually show how you really go down and looking at very rare cell subsets and how you actually measure that. But today we'll just get familiar with the terminology in case you're not familiar already. And I've given you some useful URLs where you can actually see these databases, protein databases for cluster designations, and also some basic immunology if your background is not in that area. And as I said, I realize people come from all different backgrounds in this class, and that's fine. Okay, we'll all learn together. And this gives you an example of a cluster designation database in the SwissProt database system. And you can see that it can get quite complicated. It goes now down into gene level. We have a lot of things telling not only what type of cell it is, but where it is. And that's become increasingly important, because the fascinating thing about the human genome result is that we don't have nearly as many of these proteins coming up into receptors, but also intracellular things, than we thought we did. We have a relatively small number, and the reason we have a small number is not only that we make different variations of those same things with splice variants and things like that, but also by location. So there's a whole field called location proteomics growing up, where you actually literally three-dimensionally position things within a cell, and the same protein can have totally different functions when it's in different parts of the cell. Rather fascinating thing that we didn't expect. Now, it turns out that as cells develop, they turn genes on and they turn genes off. And sometimes the genes stay on for a long time, particularly if they're so-called housekeeping genes that have to do basic cell functions. But if you really think about that and you look at the expression of any particular protein on a cell and its maturity as it goes from being, a very basic primordial cell to being a very mature differentiated cell, then you can have, if you plotted the actual numbers of these proteins on the surfaces of cells, then you would have a curve that might look like this if it's lost. Now, a particular example of that would be CD34, which is expressed on very primitive stem progenitor cells, particularly hematopoietic ones, but also, interestingly enough, on some other organ types. And you have other ones like this one, for example, CD3. This would be a CD3 expressed in the cytoplasm, but not on the surface of the cell. So CD3 comes on in the cytoplasm before it goes and gets transported out on the surface. And it actually comes on and goes off. And CD3 out on the surface of a cell might be expressed like this. So if you look at these curves, some things become obvious, and that is that if you were to measure two or three of those at once, then you could pick a particular level of maturity. You say, if antigen 3 has this much, and antigen 2 has that much, and antigen 1 has this much, then I must be right here. It must be that level of maturity of cells. So by doing this, we've been able to literally dissect all of the developmental and differentiation patterns of various cell types. And you can imagine people have gone up to more than 17 of these at a given time, so that they can actually pinpoint exactly where they are on a developmental process. So this is a very valuable tool, and we'll see some examples of this shortly. In particular, this one right here is an actual closer example of what happens. I said that was the more general concept. Here is actual human T cell lineage, for example, study. Here, CD34 is on very high for a basic blood cell type before any of these other things turn on. Here's your cytoplasmic CD3 that I told you about. CD3 comes on much later. CD7, if you wanted to study a cell in this region, you would want to have a marker that was elevated, and we've done that. We've done a lot of studies in my lab with CD34, CD7, and then we've said, oh, it's CD3 negative because it hadn't come on yet. So we knew we were in this region. So these are actual lineages. There's other cell types, for example, that here's your CD4 and CD8 that we had in that previous example of the immunophenotype that come on much later. Okay. We've talked a little bit about all of these items, where they come from, and we make these in our own body, of course, and some of the therapeutic problems and why we had to humanize them. Let's talk a little bit more about why the antibodies, while they're great conceptually and a little bit easier to work with in many ways, has some problems with them. Well, the first thing is something that you really wouldn't think of, because monoclonal antibodies were made to be highly specific, and the problem is that they are so specific that they frequently don't recognize things that we think that they ought to recognize. Now, it turns out that a monoclonal antibody can recognize a particular collection of amino acids down to about 7 amino acids. Well, it turns out that when you get down to about 7 amino acids, you'll find that collection of amino acids in a lot of different other proteins. So things will cross-react like crazy. And you'll find that the same antibody will stain totally different proteins because it's going for that one small sequence called an epitope. So it can be just so bad. And for example, when we do that, if you look at and you go look up monoclonal antibodies that you can use, they use them on so-called Western blots, where you actually are doing an electrophoresis of proteins out on a gel, and you don't care whether those antibodies stain a little bit in the wrong places, because you know where your protein is. And so if it stains in the wrong place, you say, ah, that was nonspecific staining, I'm not going to worry about that. Well, people, of course, a lot of work was done developing these for Western blots, and then people applied them to cells, and they went in and stained all kinds of things, in some cases hundreds of different proteins in a cell that they were never designed to. And when you're staining it in a cell, then all you end up with is just a lot of nonspecific staining all over everywhere. So in fact, when you actually look and you use these things for making nanomedical systems, one of the things you want to do is make sure that it's so-called flow cytometry certified, meaning it truly has a specificity against that, and you can put it amidst thousands of other proteins and it won't cross-react. And that's very, very different. So ones that work very well for Western blots may be absolutely worthless for being able to target a nanomedical system to a cell.
So what is the difference between an epitope and an antigen?
Okay, excellent question. What is the difference between an epitope and an antigen? An antigen is a collection of epitopes. May have many of them, and some of those epitopes can be shared on different antigens. You can see the same epitope expressed on different antigens. Now, back in the bad old days when we had polyclonal antibodies, we would stain all the epitopes of that receptor, and we would quite frequently see from the collection that it was staining brighter. In other words, the polyclonal may stain seven different epitopes on that antigen, whereas the monoclonal antibody might only stain one. So we get a very bright staining, and we used to say, oh, we get a little background on this other stuff because we had the equivalent of a, if you think of a polyclonal antibody, was really a collection of monoclonal antibodies. And so you got all of the subsequent background staining. Now, that's interesting. So when we ran into this problem of it being, the epitope being so abundant on other antigens, then one of the things that we quickly learned was, hey, maybe we can go back in a more controlled fashion and construct something that had the advantages of a polyclonal antibody, but not the disadvantages. Now, the disadvantages of a polyclonal antibody, just straight out of the mouse, you know, with all of its other things that it recognizes, was that you didn't know what it was, and everyone was different. But if you could make a synthetic mixture of monoclonal antibodies that would just take the ones that were relevant, then you could make something called a monoclonal cocktail. They literally call this a cocktail. And we use those cocktails a lot, as it turns out, to get the advantages and get around this problem of it being too narrow and too specific. So here's another better way of looking in answers to Nick's question about what an antigen is. And the antigen can have, again, these are regions, an antigen has regions which have different shapes, if you will. And all of these, particularly with antibodies, but also as we're going to see with peptides and with aptamers, we're still doing a shape recognition. We're still trying to actually feel things on a molecular level so that they fit in a close proximity, three dimensions. And that's important to understand because there's a lot of ways you can disturb that. So the first thing is, if we think about how an antibody recognizes with a shape recognition, and different antibodies recognize different shapes, you can have a highly specific one, and you can also have non-specific recognition, where the shape is partially there, but it's not a perfect shape match. So you'll get non-specific recognition of an epitope. And then you can get recognition of multiple epitopes. And this would be if you made a monoclonal cocktail or if you had a polyclonal antibody where you recognize multiple ones on the same cell. And it could be on the same cell, and it could be in different places. It could be on different places on the same protein. And that leads to some interesting things, because when people say, is this epitope right next to that one, there are ways to measure that using fluorescence resonant energy transfer techniques to say, is it close enough to be the proper combination of epitopes? Now, we're not going to go into that detail today, but that's something to keep in mind, is that you can actually look at the spatial distance between relative epitopes on the same antigen and say, is it in the right combination? And people have done some very elegant work in that. You can also bind. This is one of the reasons why an antibody has got lots of other things on it that can bind. And one of them is an Fc portion, and that can bind in a non-specific mode, and that there are even Fc receptors that will grab on to any this part of the antibody on any antibody, whether it has any recognition in the antigen recognition site or not. So Fc binding can be a problem. And for that reason, now we start getting into redesigning antibodies. So if we really think about this, here's the same thing with our Y. This is one part of the Y going this way, and this is one part of the Y going this way. And what you've really got is a complex combination of subunits of an antibody that are held together with disulfide bonds. And with that, there are variable regions. This is exactly analogous to what we saw before. We had the green, remember the green in the monoclonal antibody with the mouse? This is the variable region, and then we had the constant region. If we look at that, we actually can look at this thing and we can say, well, what portions are really beneficial to us? Well, all the recognition is happening up in here, not in this portion, not the tail of it. And this is called the Fc portion of the antibody. That's mostly nonspecific, and in fact, you can get rid of it, and it'll work perfectly fine without it. You can also get rid of, if you look at this, you can say, well, I don't want all this stuff in here. I just want this region right here, which has the shape recognition. So we have different names for that. If we grab both of these and we actually get the hinge region that holds the two of them together, then we have what's called an FAB2 fragment, which would be this one and this one held together. And if we cut it in yet another place, such that we have only one side of this, and it's a very small unit, then, and this is much, much smaller. So if we're going to think about using antibodies for targeting nanomedical devices to cells, we're probably going to talk about really regions of an FAB fragment, which is much, much smaller than the total structure. Now, there are specific enzyme cleavages. For example, pepsin cuts off the tail of the antibody. Papain cleaves these two away from each other so that you can end up with the FAB fragments. So you can very easily make these things and custom design. Now, people started looking at that, and human beings are never satisfied with what Mother Nature makes. They always say, well, we have a brain, let's see what we can do to make it better. So they had already spent a lot of time humanizing this and making, changing the sequences so that it would be less immunogenic for therapy in humans. So they also looked at this and they said, well, you know what? We can make those. And so the next step was saying, well, why do we really need the mouse anymore? So it turns out one of the papers in the reference list is about that. You can actually construct things that look like this as recombinant proteins in bacteria that will actually self-assemble these things and secrete them out onto the surface. And then, because they're secreted out on the surface, you can use those and test by grabbing the things that bind to what you want to bind to. So they can make libraries, huge libraries of these things. Now, the reason why antibodies work in the first place is that you have hundreds of millions of these combinations in your body. Enough so that most of the time when something new comes along, you say, well, I've got one that works for that, okay, in your repertoire. Now, so what we have to do here is we actually produce these things as a set of random mutations and permutations, and we just transmute those sequences until we get the right ones. So it's very possible to make these libraries of these particular things, and you can actually make full antibodies that look like this, displayed libraries in bacteria. You can also look at this thing and you say, well, you know, I really only need a small portion of this, and all that really is that's a peptide. So that's getting us going from either full antibodies to very particular pieces of antibodies and even recombinant antibodies, and then we can go one step further and we say, well, you know, I really only need a subset of that big protein, and a subset can be a peptide sequence. A peptide sequence is just effectively a small protein, a small collection of amino acids. So I can then, once I make a small collection of amino acids, I can sit there and I can take all kinds of, again, permutations and combinations. And this has actually grown up into a new field called chemical biology, where we know we literally synthesize, and we do this by a sort of a combinatorial chemistry or a mutation way of doing it to make all possible combinations. Now, what that does is means that you now have to have a screening method that can find that. What's the best one out of that 10 million or 100 million combinations that you just created? How are you going to find it? So in the past, that wasn't really possible. So we really didn't have the screening capabilities. Now we do, and we can actually construct these giant libraries. Okay, before I go to that part of it, let's also ask the question, I think I've got a targeting molecule. How do I know that I actually got it to where I think it should be going? So there are various ways to do that. One can put, obviously, radioactive probes on there. One can put light-absorbing dye probes. But what people have really, again, in order to get good spatial resolution, putting fluorescent probes on those allowed you to, first of all, have very small fluorescent probes, so you had very exquisite spatial clarity and where it was binding. but also you had, because it was a fluorescent molecule, you had a signal above a dark background, which is always a good thing to have. So if you hook on fluorescent molecules onto these antibodies or antibody subset structures, there's at least three different ways you can do that. One is called direct immunofluorescence, where you put the tag directly on. And we'll talk about, there's actually some reasons why you might or might not want to do that. Indirect says you don't put the fluorochrome directly on that. You have some intermediate molecule. And the reasons for that have to do with both specificity and amplification. And then we can also put other things on. We can have things which recognize each other and have the ability to survive some unusual environments. And I'll talk a little bit about what the advantages of those are. So the first thing that happens is when you put these fluorescent molecules onto an antibody, you discover a few things. And I want to warn you about this because people will go out and advertise that they have the brightest antibody out there. Okay? Well, when you bind these things to a antibody, the binding is relatively random. And when you bind a high number, there's a very good chance that you can hit a bad spot on the antibody, which will cause it to change its shape recognition. So the brightest ones, the probability is going to be much higher. I'm not saying all bright antibodies, meaning they have a lot of fluorochromes per antibody, are bad. But in general, I tend to shy away from ones which are very, very high. And I'll give you some numbers. The actual numbers here, in the range of 4 to 6 is a good 4 to 6 fluorochromes, and you'll typically be given something called an FP ratio, which is telling you how many fluorochromes you're getting per immunoglobulin. So an FP ratio of 4 to 6 is very good. And if you notice, this is a classic Poisson distribution. If you get it, again, too high, it starts to look like a Gaussian normal distribution. And this range is very good. But it turns out you have to pay attention to what's happening down here. Because if you have a very low FP ratio on your antibody or whatever you're targeting that with, then you'll notice that there's a fairly high probability that it will have zero fluorochromes on it. That's a very bad situation because those antibodies with zeros on them are going to outcompete because they haven't been altered at all. They're going to have the highest avidity for the antigen, and so they're going to outcompete all the label stuff, and you can end up with something which doesn't stain well at all. And you wonder, why is it not staining well? They told me it had an FP ratio of 1.5. What's wrong with it? Well, an FP ratio of 1.5 is probably not a very good choice because a very high fraction of the time you've got a lot of unlabeled antibody in there. Now, that said, people came along and said, well, you know, I can clean that up. So I can go with chromatography, HPLC, clean up. I can actually take a slice through this, and I can pick all the ones very tightly around 2, or all the ones here that are up maybe around 6, but not these ones that are around at 10. So an HPLC purified labeled antibody will give you typically a lot better, more reproducible staining than one that doesn't. Because otherwise, you've got all this collection of things in there competing with each other. So the ones that are very high brightness staining are going to be the least specific, and they're going to go all over everywhere. And when you actually do that, as with all things, when you're trying to target things, you have to titrate and do the chemistry on this. And the classic chemistry that you'll see, sort of curve of fluorescent intensity versus the dilution, will be this dotted line. That's what they tell you it is in the textbooks. It just isn't true. They lied. Okay, and the reason they lied is that's a nice simplified drawing, but the two critical things they didn't tell you was, one is that when you come back in here and you use antibodies at very, very high concentrations, labeling cells, they go all over everywhere. You basically force, if you put enough monoclonal antibodies on, you can stain anything. And I do mean anything. And unfortunately, when you look through a fluorescent microscope, those are the most pleasing to the eye because they're very brightly stained. So I say, if it looks pleasing to the eye, then you've overstained it. Don't do that. Now, this characteristic along here, they'll say, oh, it should be flat. Well, how in the world would you ever know that it was flat? You should ask yourself that. They give you all this advice and they never tell you how to do it. Well, the way that you do it is that you actually literally take three concentrations of your antibody, three or four, and you stain cells and you do flow cytometry with those, and we'll talk a lot more about flow cytometry next time, but it's a way of actually measuring the actual fluorescence per cell. And if you do that, you will get some points along here, and you'll get virtually your peak positions will be virtually identical. Very, very small variations. Now, if you dilute out too far, what you notice is that you're understaining, because all of a sudden you've got more antigen than you have antibody. So you're not even staining everything. And that's a bad thing. So you always want to be in a region where you have more antibody than you have antigen. And that can have a lot of ramifications from Nick's question as to how many epitopes that it has and all those issues. So you want to stay in this region. Now, that seems like a simple thing to do. You stain it once and you do it. I can tell you from personal experience that it isn't simple, because now you come along and let's say you chemically induce cells to differentiate. You know what you can do? You can upregulate or downregulate genes. And if you upregulate genes, then all of a sudden you can fall right off the curve. And I did that. I was one of the first people to do that in the lab, and it took me a lot of head scratching to figure out what it was. Because we were doing a lot of induction of things and flipping genes on and off. So the same cells under a particular treatment, a hormone treatment or a chemical inducing treatment, can upregulate, downregulate, and you can find yourself in the wrong region. So, and that leads to a real struggle. What do you do if you want to compare a control with an induced? I had to really fight my early papers on this to get people to accept that I could actually compare two things stained at slightly different dilutions, but they were comparable, as opposed to they were very insistent that you do the same thing, which is, you know, the strategy that you use when you don't know what else to do. You know, if I don't change it, then I can't be accused of changing it. But if I don't change it, I'm doing something in this case that's pretty stupid, and I'm comparing something that is literally fallen off the curve with something that's still on the curve. So there's a lot of these subtleties that you get into. But we can talk about that later. So here's a case of direct immunofluorescence and with a specific antibody. And you notice most of the time when I draw these, I'll put the fluorochromes. This is like a fluorescein isothiocyanate molecule. And I'll attach those to this Fc portion of the antibody. And the reason is I want to get these as far away from here and here as possible. Unfortunately, if I, again, as in that Poisson binding, if I keep adding more and more Fitzy molecules to this, sooner or later I'm going to get some up in here, and it's going to start changing the structure, changing the shape recognition, and it will no longer recognize what it's supposed to do. And you notice that there are different types of Fc portions, and you'll notice that with this designation, IgG2a, for example, has some very particular subregions down in here that other antibodies can recognize, and you can take advantage of that. In this particular case, you also want to think about what your controls are. So if you have a nonspecific antibody, you like to have the same Ig subclass so that it basically has the same kind of binding. And here's the tough one. Try for the same number of fluorochromes per Ig. And that one is almost impossible to get the same. One way you can do that is you can actually make a cocktail of different ones and try to average it out. And so that on an averaged basis, it'll act like a polyclonal. It'll stain and it'll work it all out. But it's a very hard thing to do. Okay. Now, I mentioned that sometimes because we do the shape recognition with this antibody, wouldn't it be better if we just had a second antibody recognize some of those regions along the Fc portion and put the fluorochromes on the secondary antibody? It also makes things a whole lot easier in terms of controls and knowing what you stain, Because if you have a nonspecific antibody, you can use the same secondary. And you get around that problem that I just mentioned to you about how do you get the same number of fluorescent molecules on a nonspecific antibody as a specific one. So indirect ones has that advantage in terms of it's usually better specificity, and it also has what's called an amplification factor, because you noticed on the previous one I only had 3 fluorochromes, and here I show an example where I have 5. And in fact, if you do indirect immunofluorescence, you quite commonly will get 2 to 3 times as much fluorescence per antigen as you will with direct immunofluorescence. And you see the controls. It's a much nicer system of controls. Now, that said, if that were true, why would anybody want to do direct immunofluorescence? Well, the problem comes is that if you're trying to recognize more than one of these things, because then you have to work out a very sophisticated secondary system that recognizes different kinds of primaries and does not cross-react. And that's not an easy thing to do. Even doing double indirect immunofluorescence is a little tricky. Okay, one other thing that people do is they attach small molecules like biotin. Now, biotin is a vitamin. It's a small molecule, and it's practically, for your purposes and for purposes of making nano devices, it's practically indestructible. It's nature's indestructible molecule. You can put it into incredibly harsh environments, nasty conditions, and the biotin will survive, and it will still be recognized by its counter molecule called avidin. Avidin binds biotin stronger than an antibody binds an antigen. It's one of the strongest connections that we know of. And the advantage is of avidin, 2 advantages. One is it's a big molecule. That's nice because you can put a lot of proteins in it and not affect much its binding to the biotin. One thing you'll notice on this biotin is you should always have a tail on it, and that's a molecular spacer arm, typically 12 to 14 because you need to be able to swing it out there away from a surface so that the avidin can recognize it. If you don't do that, then the avidin just can't get itself into the right orientations to bind. And in fact, what will happen is that if you have a lot of targets on a cell and you try to do, and they're close together, the problem is then you won't get an accurate accounting of that. So if that's important to you, then you would want to use one of the direct or indirect immunofluorescent labeling techniques. Okay. Now, as I said, the chief advantage of biotin, and it was used a lot for all of the chromosome mapping experiments and things, because they found they could put biotin on DNA precursors, and they could put it into really, really harsh chemicals, and the biotin came through it just fine. And then you could come along with avidin and label that, you know, find that biotin and label it. Okay. Now, so what are some of the problems and complications with antibodies? Well, first of all these good things that I've told you happen when cells are live. When cells are not live, they tend to get very sticky, and they put out all kinds of things that non-specifically bind antibodies. And so, as I said, the brightest staining cells in your cell mixture are typically going to be your dead and damaged cells. Now, most people don't worry a lot about that because they sit there and they have the perfect prep. It's an in vitro application, and they've got, you know, 97-98% live cells, undamaged cells. And that sounds great for most antibody staining. And then I say to you, well, that's nice, but when you're making an in vivo nanomedical system, you're going to have to go down not 1 or 2 parts in 100, you're going to have to go down 1 or 2 parts in 100,000 or 1 million. So at those kinds of levels, the nonspecific binding to dead cells become extremely important. That's all you're going to measure. If you go looking for cells at 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1 million in vivo, the amount of binding that you're going to get is going to be overwhelmingly due to cells that are dying and damaged and so on, because that's happening all the time. It happens in tissue culture. It happens in our body. There's a lot of things about the specifics of the binding and cross-binding for indirect immunofluorescence, and I don't think I'll go into that. Another thing that you can have is when you're in the in vivo situation is you put antibodies into a person, and I told you previously about immunotherapies that we do so-called directed therapies. What you'll find is that typically 40% to 80% of those antibodies that you put into a person in directed therapy are actually eaten by phagocytic cells, by monocytes and macrophages. So that's going to happen, and you have to kind of figure that in and try to find ways to avoid that. The other thing is that when you bind things up to a cell, you activate things on the cell surface. It's sort of like you touch it and you make it flinch, and it reacts to things that when you're touching the surface of a cell. And one of the things that happens, and one of the reasons why when we talk about making, I told you that the full, you know, sort of standard Y-type structure, bivalent antibody structure of the entire molecule has a problem because of that Y structure, it tends to pull things around on the cell surface. Well, a lot of things that happen on the cell surface happen when receptors are moved and they're brought into close proximity with each other. A fascinating little thing is knowing that you may think that insulin is what cures diabetes. It's not. It's the insulin receptor. Insulin causes the insulin receptors to cluster, and then those clustered insulin receptors internalize. Okay, and that happens a lot for when things get taken into a cell. It's because things get clustered. And when you have bivalent antibodies, you really tend to cluster things. So that ends up so-called patching things on the surface, moving them around. Eventually, they can actually move them right off to the side, you know, one side of a cell, and you have something that looks like a cap. And the next thing that happens usually after a cap is the cell throws it away and sheds it. So patching, capping, and shedding of bound antibodies. And the same thing can happen depending on how you bind your nanomedical device, that you can actually patch and cap and shed your nanomedical device. Lots of other things here. I mentioned about immunogenicity in host and too large for nanomedical systems. Again, those are things that you want to keep in mind. So you'll see I have some prejudice that antibodies are great for prototyping purposes, but I think if you're going to use them long term for making some device that's actually going to work in vivo, you're probably going to, at the very least, have to use subsets of that antibody, like FAB fragments, or you're going to have to make some recombinant form that you can really exquisitely adjust and make it very small. Okay, let's talk a little bit about peptide targeting. You know, what is different about that? Well, if you think about, really, I think at least of an antibody as almost like a collection of peptides of those different regions. And if you think in those terms, then I think you realize that a peptide is targeting much the same way that an antibody is. It has to have enough amino acids to have some kind of structural recognition. And you don't need very much of that. And we learned that with monoclonal antibodies, that a very small region actually did most of the work for the recognition. So we'll talk a little bit about some particular peptides, and I'm going to show you one that's surprisingly small that does some amazing things in the next slide. And show you a little bit about, again, describing about high throughput screening. Most of that I'll talk on Thursday about high throughput screening techniques and the advantages and disadvantages of this. So here's one that we've used in our lab. And this was a peptide library that was actually originally expressed as a phage library in bacteria. And it was a random library, so it was a very large library and then had to be screened. So these made all kinds of different combinations of peptide sequences to see which ones had recognition for what you're looking for and which ones didn't. They also noticed they did pre-absorption on these cell types, peripheral blood mononuclear cells, for example, because this is what I told you back in the days of polyclonal antibodies. You recognize that there's an awful lot of other things that it can react with. So you don't want it to, if you're looking for rare circulating breast cancer cells, you certainly don't want these libraries coming up with something that may recognize the circulating breast cancer cells, but they also recognize some component of blood cells, because those blood cells are going to outnumber them thousands to one. And you're not going to be able to see anything. You're also going to cause, if you have a therapy on that, you may destroy an awful lot of blood cells as collateral damage. So what they did was they actually did the preabsorption first, then they did a panning technique. And that's a very crude technique, but surprisingly effective, where you actually put those peptides on a surface and you simply move the cells all across those, see which ones actually attach and adhere those. And so you literally just pan them on a large surface. And then you try growing those things up, those libraries, the ones that look successful, and you do flow cytometry. And again, you do a sequence analysis to actually say that there are different sequences. Now, what you will find on that, and I won't show you on this, but I'll show you on one on the aptamer slide, is that you will come up with what we call consensus sequences. That is, there'll be some things, some amino acids in common for several of them that might work. And so what you end up doing is you end up zeroing in and saying, gee, this one works better than that one, and sequence is just different because of this amino acid in this position. And you start looking down through and you come up with something that's better, hopefully better and better. Well, they did this for this group and published it. And the nice thing is that once people have made these libraries and screened them, and they published the sequence, that's wonderful because everybody can use them and they don't have to go through all of, this was a lot of pain to do this. This is not fun. But once you have this sequence, and again, one of the people in my group is using this to both in vitro, and we just finished this summer a series of animal experiments where we use this in animals to find these tumors put in nude mice, where we actually put the peptide sequence on. So basically, and to be able to see the nanoparticle, because the nanoparticles are so small, rather than using at this point a fluorescent antibody which can photobleach, what we did was we put this onto a quantum dot nanoparticle and put this particular amino acid sequence onto that, which would recognize this SKBR3 human metastatic breast cancer cell line, which we then put inside subcutaneously in nude mice, and then put these particles in the tail vein. So we did an IV injection into the tail vein of the mouse and said, basically, go find the tumor cells. And if, assuming that the tumor cells actually vascularized and caused blood vessels to be formed around them so that they could grow, then, which actually did happen in this case when we dissected them back out, then these particles were able to get there. So you can then measure them by image analysis or confocal imaging to see where they are. And here's an example. And so you can see this a little bit better. It turns out that SKBR3 cells are positive for this recognizing this peptide. So if this peptide is hooked onto a quantum dot, which in this case is a red quantum dot, we're staining the nuclei of the cell so we can see where they are. And then in the same region, we can see that these cells are labeling in here as a SKBR3. This is what we wanted it to target. The negative cell line, MCF7, another human breast cancer cell line, you notice the only ones that you're really getting here is a cell which is damaged. And if you come over here again with a positive control, this is a quantum dot with a peptide that just goes, stains everything and goes into the cell and stains everything. So this peptide not only goes to the cell surface, but it gets quickly pulled across the cell membrane into the cytoplasm. And they sell this, they call it Q-tracker, if you buy these things commercially, like from Invitrogen. So this is a 100% positive control. Here you see it's not 100% positive, but it's closer. And here's, again, a 100% positive on Q-tracker on the SKBR3. So here's the more or less desired result, not perfect, but shows that the total process works. Basically, this is a confocal movie that you can see that they're actually inside the cell and not on the cell surface. So this particular peptide sequence not only goes to the surface of these SKBR3 cells, but it goes across the cell surface into the cytoplasm. And if you remember our model, remember I told you that if you really conceptually think of all nanomedical systems as multi-layered, this one has the first two layers. It has the binding to the cell surface and the intracellular delivery all in one peptide sequence. But conceptually, it's done two steps. And in fact, if you there are other peptides that will go, this particular one doesn't, but there are other peptides that will go a third step and retarget to the nucleus of the cell. And we've done that with HIV TAT peptide sequence, for example. Okay, well, let's talk about the third basic type of targeting. Now, one thing I didn't tell you about antibodies are that antibodies are pretty fragile. They're large proteins. We indicated if you put fluorochromes on them, they can change shape. They're also very hard to store because if they get dried out, then they lose their specificity. So people tried making all kinds of protein arrays with recognizing proteins with antibodies, and it's very hard to produce those, ship those, quality control those, because you just can't. It's very hard to keep them moist and keep them from the proteins, antibody proteins, from denaturing. One of the advantages of an aptamer is an aptamer is just typically a DNA or RNA sequence. And if it's a DNA sequence, it's almost indestructible. So you can store it under some pretty extreme circumstances, and it will last, it'll last through those very, very well. So aptamers, what are they? Aptamers are RNA or DNA sequences which have shape recognition. And typically, they're 40 to 80 nucleotides long. So you notice that that peptide was, about 10 amino acids. So we're talking about a nucleotide typically 40 to 80 nucleotides long. And depending on it will have some secondary structure to it such that it will have shape recognition. Not all of them, obviously, but a subset of them will. So you can make them out of RNA. You can make them out of DNA. Nature does some of these on its own. And they target again by shape recognition the same way. So you can think of this as the same kind of thing that happens with the peptides and the antibodies. We make those by combinatorial chemistry. So now we're really synthetically doing it all the way to the nucleotide level and literally doing random portions of that. And you can imagine that by the time you get up to 40 or 80, and depending on how many of those are constant regions, you can have a constant region of an aptamer such that you can do a multiplex interaction where you have, let's say, three or four or five different recognition aptamers, and you can have the same sequence on all of them, and you can PCR amplify on that common sequence. So it'll recognize only those and nothing else. And that's a strategy which is going to be very attractive when we think about making a more complex targeting device here. So let's go a little further into that. And I'll give you an example. My own experience is all with thioaptamer libraries. These are double-stranded DNA aptamers that have sulfurs in the backbone, substituted into the backbone, which make them a little bit funny, kinky shapes, but gives a higher, if anything, maybe a higher recognition, and at least that's our theory, that it does even better recognition than a regular straight double-stranded DNA aptamer. They're also extremely stable. So we did this, and we made, by combinatorial chemistry, we made it so we grew these things effectively on beads by a process that I'll get into here shortly. So that we made these beads. We started out with 80 micron beads. They were very large, too big for flow cytometry, for at least what we were trying to do. And this is what they actually looked like. So when we had the very large ones, we literally, the first ever thioaptamer bead sorting was done by my graduate student holding it up to the light with a razor blade and actually doing the equivalent of picking them out one at a time. And we have a famous photo in one of the papers that I gave you, which shows called bead on a stick, which we call our piece of art. was bead on a stick, and it was an 80 micron bead, and it was a major embarrassment to my graduate student, so we made sure that he saw it a lot. So we immortalized that one. And there it is. There's bead on a stick. And I literally had to pick it up with micromanipulators and grab it out. So he went in there with a pair of micromanipulators and actually picked them up one at a time. And then we did sequencing. PCR amplified it and did the sequencing. And those were how the very first ones were done. So needless to say, you could go through an awful lot of graduate students. And believe it or not, you may think graduate students are cheap, but if you pick them up one at a time and you have to feed them all that pizza, those graduate students are not cheap, okay? Even pizza costs a lot when you have that many graduate students doing that much. So what we had to do was reduce the size of those. So we reduced them from 80 microns down to 20 microns in diameter, and then we were able to put them through a flow cytometer. So instead of Tarl picking one of these things up every few minutes, we would run at rates of on the order of 5 to 10,000 per second, which was a little faster, and ended up being cheaper, saving pizza costs. And when you do that, we actually did this. This is a particular one we were doing a thioapter against the two different subunits of NF-kappa-B, which is a very important protein in a cell. This is the P65 unit and the P50 unit. And we're actually able to come up with a one thioaptamer which recognized the epitope of the P65 and another thioaptamer that recognized the P50 and that they wouldn't cross react with each other. Which is pretty good actually, because those are not easy things to make work. So that was kind of a demonstration project that we did. And this just shows the combinatorial process of making these. And you see these can be variable or constant regions of that. And the advantage of all of this is that I told you about the amplification techniques that we could use to get it a little brighter with an antibody or get the peptide a little bit brighter. But think about it, if you can PCR amplify, do an in vitro amplification of the DNA and make a million copies of something. Now you've really expanded it up. And so we're actually doing this now, this same idea, to make what we call DNA barcoding, which is a project Trish has been working on recently, where we can actually put in known sequences and we can actually literally, well, I would say the graduate students are burning their initials in the DNA right now. So they have you're doing the Mary Margaret one. So one of our graduate students, Mary Margaret, is basically has her name and I guess a date in that one. But the idea was that we could put in actually experimental dates and protocols right into the sequence, the oligonucleotide sequence, and it could be put into the constant region of an aptamer, so that you could literally put in multiple treatments in vivo and know which one you were measuring later on. So it's really kind of a nice idea. It's a variation on the German microdot writing during World War II, when they wrote whole messages in the periods and inside sentences. You had to look at them under a microscope. The one difference here is we have to actually sequence the DNA to figure out what the code is. So modern methods. So when you do that, when you actually look at these sequences and you start selecting and you say which ones work, and we actually literally sorted these ones and we found out that we had some of them would bind brightly and some would not bind brightly to the target, and we would start to develop what would be consensus sequences. So you'd say what was common to all of these things in the brighter binding ones, and you gradually start zeroing in on the most important sequences here. So we selected those. We started out with a one bead, one polypeptide library. That was before my time, one bead small molecule. I started out at this level right here with a one bead, one oligonucleotide. So where we did thioaptamers that were in the 40 to 80 nucleotide region, and publish that, and I'll give you copies of those papers. So you very quickly can come up with a library of the size of about 10 to the 8. That's 100 million combinations And the question is, could we invent a technique that we could actually look through 100 million different possible thioaptamer things in one day? And the work got a little interrupted when I moved here, but we did a smaller library of 10 million in a little over 2 hours. So I think we could do, in a somewhat long day, we could do 100 million in a day. Now that's kind of fantastic, and you say, wow, 100 million, except that the guys who make these combinatorial libraries aren't satisfied with 100 million. That's too small. You know, your repertoire in your body is somewhere between 100 million and a billion estimated possible combinations. But we want to try combinations that go beyond that, that have recognition that, you know, so many possibilities that you can look at nuances. So some of the numbers that we're next working up to, we're up to 10 to the 14th power. And you start saying, with a high-speed cell sorter that you're going to see on Thursday, even if that one at 100,000 cells a second, 10 to the 14th is an awful big number. That's a lot of seconds. Okay, and it turns out that's not even fast enough. So then you start thinking about this thing saying, what if I had a bead where every bead was its own library? And you did a two-step on this so that each bead... So you had 10 to the 8th beads that you could analyze. That's a reasonable number to analyze. And every bead had 10 to the 6th possible combinations, so a million, 100 million beads with 1 million different sequences on each bead, so that you could cut through 10 to the 14th in a reasonable period of time. You would then pick out the ones that worked, where one, at least one of them, one of the sequences in that 10 to the 6th worked, and then you'd make your secondary library, you'd throw away all of the other vast amount of the 10 to the 14th power, and you'd zero in on your ones that worked. So that we have not done yet. Nobody's done that yet. I hope to do that here. But we need to get that ramp up production again. So this is kind of what it looks like for high throughput based aptamer library. And whether it's a thioaptamer or an aptamer, it's very similar. And here, we did a high-speed flow cytometry. The interesting thing is we actually took a sort and we did a MALDI-TOF mass spectrometry, and it turns out you don't have to take the beads off. You can just take it right to the mass spectrometer, and you can do a MALDI-TOF. And I didn't show you the sequences here, but they're actually in one of the papers that I think I gave to you or assigned to you. And so we checked this, you know, as far as checking this with whether our thioaptamer actually had a specificity for the NF-kappa B. We did this by flow cytometry. And the reason we did that, this particular one as a demonstration project, was there do happen to be monoclonal antibodies against the P60 and P65 and P50 subunits of NF-kappa B so that we could test it. So we did that and did the flow cytometry and two-color flow cytometry to see the P60 units and the P50 units. And you can see, as we did here in this particular one, we had separate aptamers that we could recognize those sequences. And again, you'll have the paper to look at that in more detail. So next time, what we'll do is I'll send you these papers, and we'll talk a little bit more about how we actually do the kinds of screenings and recognition. Talk a little bit about flow cytometry, high throughput image analysis, how those things are done, and then how you actually test your targeting quantitatively. How do you know what it really is as you go down through and see what and predict what the accuracy of that is? Okay, any questions? So three general classes of targeting molecules, and then there's a lot of nuances as you start getting into the recombinant antibodies and the various ways that you can make phage libraries of peptide sequences. But the idea, I think what we're trying to do is, again, with the theme of making things synthetically as much as possible, where you know exactly what you've got and that you can just closely define that. And that's another reason why I'm more, if anything, prejudiced more toward peptides and aptamers than I am to antibodies, although we are also doing some experiments with some nanomedical systems with a particular antibody that's being made by a pharmaceutical firm. So, but you know, they have that particular antibody where it's been designed to go in heavily humanized sequences, and it's designed to go into, you know, you almost want it to have some interaction with the immune system to cause some secondary interactions to kill tumor cells. But usually you don't have that situation. Usually you don't want the immune system interacting with your nanomedical system. So I think I'll end that here. We're out of time, but if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those. Stick around for a little bit longer.